don't we have fun?
All right, thank you. I'd like to call the meeting to order for the Goleta Planning Commission for today, April 25th. If you'd all rise and join me in the pledge, please.
Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you very much, everyone. Everyone's seated already. If we can now have our clerk do our roll call, please.
Thank you. Commissioner Daniels?
Present.
Commissioner Fuller?
Present.
Commissioner Maynard?
Present.
Vice Chair Jenkins?
Here.
Chair Onan?
Here.
Thank you.
And at this time, we do have an opportunity for a public forum, and that's where you have the ability to speak to the Planning Commission on anything within the jurisdiction of the City of Goleta that is not on tonight's agenda. And I have no speaker slips for the public forum. Madam Clerk, do you have anything on the public forum?
No, Chair Onan.
Okay, so we will open and close our public forum, and we'll go to our director and see if we have any amendments or adjustments.
There are none.
No amendments or adjustments. So we're going to go to item A1. If our clerk could read those into the record.
Item A1 is the Planning Commission minutes for the special Planning Commission meeting of March 21st, 2016.
All right. Any discussion or motions on the minutes for the meeting of March 21st? That's the first item that we're going to take.
I have a few small ones.
Please. Okay.
On page 13, 1741, 110, C2, there's an if-then statement and there needs to be a then. So it says, Commissioner Maynard supported Design Review Board's review if an individual sign submitted is a variance or is not compliant with the applicable sign program. It should say, then it should go to DRB. And then that's clarified in the language. So a quick clarification there. And I had one other one. On page 15, 1742-040-D3, I had made a comment about litter, and Vice Chair Jenkins supported the language with the litter, and so I then learned from Vice Chair Jenkins why that was important, so I then agreed with Vice Chair Jenkins. So I just wanted to note that I agreed with Vice Chair Jenkins after he clarified that. That's all I've got.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One item on page 14, item number 17.42030B4. It talks about Vice Chair Jenkins suggested adding restaurants to the list of uses prohibited from being accessory uses. And that was not the intent of the comment. What I was actually suggesting was adding restaurants to the list of exceptions. So specifically under B4 talks about bar, nightclub, lounge, except in hotels, resorts, and golf courses, and I was suggesting adding restaurants to the list of hotels, resorts, and golf courses. So that's all I had.
All right. Anything else? Commissioner Daniels?
Chair, call to order says our roll call is talks to me, and it says Commissioner Daniels was present. And I was absent.
On the 21st?
Yes.
No, that was the meeting before last week. Yeah, last week is the next set we're going to go to.
Okay.
So is that, yeah, you were, so he was present on the 21st.
Apologize. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Commissioner Fuller.
Yeah, two changes. On page 5, 17.41.030.p, it wasn't about mobile vendors, it was about push carts that I have an objection to, and therefore signs for them. Also on page 24, 17.42.330, I wasn't aware I was vice chair yet.
Oh, you got a promotion. So we want to bump him back down to commissioner.
Or that might have been Vice Chair Jenkins' comment.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah, so it should be Vice Chair Jenkins.
That should be corrected?
Yes.
Okay. All right, any other comments or corrections to the minutes? Did we get all those? All right. We can, if anyone would like to make a motion.
I would move to approve as amended.
We have a first. Do we have a second?
I second.
You have a first and a second. Any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
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 It looks unanimous, so we won't call for any other votes. All right, so now we're in item A2, I believe. Madam Clerk, if you would read item A2 into the record for us.
Item A2 is the Planning Commission minutes for the Planning Commission meeting of April 11th, 2016.
All right, thank you. So, any comments on these minutes? Seeing none, we do, is this the one that you were concerned whether you were at this meeting, Commissioner Daniels? Okay, got it.
I see that I'm absent on this one. Thank you.
Okay, good. So no, hearing no comments or amendments, anyone like to make a motion?
Move to approve the minutes of April 11th.
We have second.
A first and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Again, I hear unanimous, or did I hear?
Aye, sorry.
Okay. We have unanimous on the minutes of the meeting of April 11th. That brings us to our public workshop, B1.
Thank you. Item B1 is the workshop. It's review of the draft zoning ordinance outstanding items.
All right. Who's taking this on?
That would be me.
Ms. Wells.
First, congratulations on the completion of the page turn on April 11th. I had to pause there for a minute. Time's going by fast. Staff's gearing up to work on those revisions and get an underlined strike through out for the public review and for Planning Commission review. But before we can really complete that work, we need your input on some outstanding items. And that's the purpose of this 8th public workshop. So thank you. I'm happy to see so many people from the public present here today. Always makes for a better discussion when we have people from our public. The packet that you received last week for this public meeting includes some information, background information for you that we will be using when we do our revision. So there's some tables. There's two tables that include sign comparison. So one, the existing sign language and the draft proposed sign language that we'll be looking at to do some updates for the revision. And then also the Design Review Board 2004 recommended sign ordinance compared to this proposed language so that you can also see what we're looking at as we proceed to make our revisions. So I wanted to make sure you knew about that. Also, the Design Review Board minutes from their last meeting are included in the packet along with the some background on recreational vehicle ordinances for seven different cities. So those are just provided for you for your use. But let's focus more on what we're talking about tonight. So what we need feedback from you on is four items. One is recreational vehicles in residential districts. A second subject is signs, and then the third is community assembly. And then the fourth item is some design review comments that we received from Design Review Board. There's four things that we want your direction on. So I'm just going to, since I just gave you the presentation agenda, skip past it.
Okay, so is our intention here to go through the commission's discussion at each interval?
I think it would make the most sense to be able to go through the present. You know, we could. I think I see what you're getting at. We could do the staff presentation, and then we could take public comment on each item if you would like, and then if people aren't interested in all of the subjects, they could leave, but it's up to you. So there's a few different ways we
can
do this.
Each slide has a question.
Right.
And so that may be, you know, if we talk about it, then what Ms. Wells is suggesting, that we do the public comment and kind of take it in chunks. That may be the most efficient way to have public comment tonight.
Public comments broken down by section, so they're all under B1.
Correct. Or you could do it now.
So I would suggest that we ask the public to give us their comments, so we have their comments fresh in our minds as we go through each section.
Right.
And if there's something that is omitted and we need to hear from someone from the public, if we could at that time. But if that makes sense to the commission, we bring the public up and go through that, and then we'll go through each section, and we'll answer the questions that are asked as we go through. All right? Do we have any more speakers?
No, I gave you the last few that I received.
But we're going to let staff do their slide presentation first?
We're going to go through each slide presentation, because each slide actually asked for a response from us as we go through them. Because, you know, we've reviewed the material, discussed it, made inputs on it, and now it's hopefully where we're answering those specific questions. So, and at each interval, we want to make sure we've had the public comment that would go to that. So I think the best thing is to ask the public to come up and give us all their comments. All right. So we'll start off with Jim Fox, followed by Lisa Christensen.
Thank you. My name is Jim Fox. I live over by the Goleta Valley Junior High. I've been in the same house for 38 years. I'm retired and I'm a RV owner. I have a fifth wheel, about a 35-foot fifth wheel. And when the parking ordinance, the oversized vehicle parking ordinance was passed, I was a little concerned, because when I use my RV, I can't park it in my driveway. I've got to park it on the street, and you know, I want to get ready the day or two before I leave. And you have to get a permit, and then when you come back, you got to go through the same process, you know, the same permit, but you have to have a permit, you have to know when you're coming back. And I thought it was onerous, and I still do, but I've managed to live with it. But at the same time, when that parking ordinance was passed, our feeling was that it was going to force people to park RVs on their front lawn. Now, I don't keep mine at my house. I pay about $100 a month up at Lake Kachuma, which not only is it expensive, it's inconvenient. It's 30 miles away. When I'm going to go on a trip, I have to go 30 miles up, 30 miles back, park it in front of my house. I still need a permit, load it, go park, camp, and come back, et cetera. So it's a pain in the neck. But I know that the city, with their zoning proposals, it's a 400-page document. And in that section, you talk about the purpose and applicability is to protect and enhance the character of well-established residential neighborhoods. And then it goes on to say that establish and develop design standards to help create distinct and attractive residential neighborhoods. Now, RV in the front yard or in the side yard, sticking out in the front yard, doesn't enhance anything. And I know the screening that they talked about with a 6-foot screening fence, and I know that the staff doesn't recommend that anymore, but a 6-foot fence isn't going to hide a 12-foot RV. The other thing is I wanted to point out is they used the cities in Los Angeles as comparable for RV storage, but I don't really understand why they didn't use Santa Barbara or Carpinteria, Pasadena, San Marino, or Carmel. Why'd they use something in L.A.? You know, none of us like the quality of life that's in L.A. or we'd live there. And I think that's it. I think the setbacks were established to leave space between houses, not fill it in with RVs and sheds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Lisa Christensen, followed by Cecilia Brown.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking all of our comments and our concerns and seeing us on all these many working trips that we've had here to meet with everybody. We really do appreciate it. Ditto to Mr. Fox on everything that he said. We are also RV owners, new RV owners. Bought one in 2015 when we adopted our grandchildren so that we could take them on trips. We're raising a 5- and a 7-year-old. As I read through the ordinance, thank you. We do appreciate this. Our RV is only a 25-footer. It does not park in these short driveways that we have in Goleta. And many of you that live in Goleta know that these driveways are very small in residential homes. Our RV is, like I said, a 2015. It's registered. It's new. We use it when we can, when the girls are out of school. It's parked on the side, and thank you for no setback, because we wouldn't be able to have it on our side of our yard. What my concern is that you wrote that it needed to be parked in an approved driveway or other approved parking areas with access to it. And rather than taking out part of our lawn and putting concrete in case we decide to upgrade, which we need to in this house that we're in with these two children now we took on, I don't think it would be it would be a real eyesore for somebody to come in and want to purchase that home for us if we have made a permanent parking area on the side of our home rather than grass. Right now we've got it on gravel with pavement underneath and pavers that we can move it in and out of very nicely, and that's very easy to pick back up again. My husband can put the sprinkler systems in. We can put the lawn or whatever else landscaping we're going to do. But to require to have some kind of a permanent driveway, if we need to have a permanent driveway, not on our lawns, because I think that the resale value of our homes may go down because our next person that may purchase that may not have a motorhome that's going to be parking. So again, I thank you all for your approval on this and your hard work and your diligence. And there's just a little bit more tweaking that we need to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Cecilia Brown, followed by Barbara Remick.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, Planning Commissioners. This evening, I'd like to speak to item number two about signs and their control mechanisms. Since electronic signs are being allowed for now in gas stations, fuel pricing signs, and theater marquees, they are otherwise will be located on public and quasi-public land uses, most of which, where I live, are in residential zone districts. So when you consider the control mechanisms, you also need to consider the appropriateness of this kind of signage in a residential zone district versus the conditions for electronic signs in commercial zone districts where public and quasi-public land uses are also can be located. Many jurisdictions only allow electronic signs by zone district, not land use. So it's unusual for the city to doing it by land use because I believe this complicates how you should be considering the control mechanisms for these signs. I don't believe these signs are appropriate in neighborhoods at all, but in commercial zone districts, they are appropriate, where signs are already part of the visual landscape. In neighborhoods, it is a wholly different case. There are almost no signs in the neighborhoods. I think there are two in my neighborhood, and Commissioner Jenkins and yours, Commissioner Ahn and then Daniels. One on the church on Fairview and one on at Cambridge. But these are static changeable copy signs with traditional lighting. Introduction of electronic signage in neighborhoods will be a game changer. They will be incompatible with the residential setting and inconsistent with general plan policies. In fact, Mr. Fox spoke to some of those policies. These signs aren't appropriate, and what the ordinance attempts to do is try to make them appropriate through various control mechanisms. The best control is to have them, not to have them in residential zone districts, but only in commercial zone districts, the public and quasi-public land uses, where they could have signs, or just allow electronic signs on public land uses. That is also a solution. That alone would solve a big problem about their intrusiveness into residential life and the impacts to residential neighborhoods. I'd like also to speak for a moment, if I may have a few moments, Annette. I'd hope that we had be able to see the slides because some of that information might be clarified about what is being proposed for some of the control mechanisms. But you understand about the display duration. They're changing it from, I think it was from 4 to 8 seconds. And I don't know if that's appropriate. Is it appropriate for Goleta? Have you even had that discussion? This is what staff is proposing. As you can see, I gave it one instance for another city in the U.S. where the display durations are different. But for quasi-public land uses in neighborhoods, I don't believe that there should be changing copy signs, electronic signs. Static non-electronic changeable copy signs are suitable. Brightness controls, and this is where I was hoping to see the slides to get some explanation. The staff report says that sign light intensity is being changed to 3-foot candles. This is the standard used for traditional lighted signs at night. It won't work for electronic signs during the day, where light levels, the luminance coming from these signs, needs to be at a much greater, higher level in order to see the signs through the ambient sunlight. So it's, I don't know, 100-foot candles. I have no idea. I don't know the relationship between foot candles and nits, which is how you measure the luminance, the luminance from signs. And also the calculation that's performed to ensure that there are appropriate levels of brightness, I don't get that either, and I'm hoping that maybe Ms. Wells would have explained that tonight. And in my letter to you, I explained that there may be other standards that might be better. But one standard you do need to add is about photosensitive equipment to automatically adjust the brightness and sign contrast in relation to ambient outdoor illumination. This would be helpful. You didn't mention about light trespass and any control for that. For any properties, commercial properties located next to residential zone districts, there should be zero light trespass from electronic signage. None. It is not acceptable for residential properties to have take any increase in the ambient light nighttime lighting because of an electronic sign next door. Hours. Many jurisdictions control the hours. If you see the fuel pricing sign at Encina and Fairview, it's turned off after the business closes. So there needs to be some sort of hours. Hopefully these signs aren't going to be on all night. Limiting the time they can operate is also good for reducing glare, light pollution, energy consumption. And hopefully there won't be any of these signs at night in the neighborhoods. It just doesn't make any sense. These signs, because of their luminance, would be the brightest spot on the streetscape, much brighter than the traditionally lighted static changeable copy signs we see at the churches. It isn't appropriate for a sign, an electronic sign, that's really more appropriate in a commercial area to be in a residential neighborhood. There's other standards about display characteristics that to eliminate the animation between changing copies, and hopefully you've read that, and they shouldn't be allowed to glimmer and flash and do all those other things. And the other thing you need to add is about sign malfunction, another regulation, so ensure that if there is a malfunction and they are flashing uncontrollably, that the signs go dark or that they're turned off, and that needs to be added. So those are my comments. Thank you for the additional time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Barbara Remick, followed by Dana Trout.
Can I have a question for staff at this point?
Sure.
I'm just wondering, Ms. Brown has had a lot of letters sent to us, and I just want to make sure we've got them all.
Yes.
Yes? Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hello, Planning Commission.
Hello.
Last time I was here, I spoke to you and I described how I recently left teaching after 30 years to follow a dream of being a full-time self-employed artist. And that dream is coming to fruition, but my RV plays a big part in that. So when I attend art shows, I'm able to use my RV instead of a hotel. So I was thrilled last week when I saw the new wording, the new language that has redefined and approved RV parking within the front setback of my home. And all of it's great. The RV registration for operation, not a problem. Nobody's going to be living in my RV. But I would like a little clarification on the regulation regarding RVs to be parked on an approved driveway with access provided via a city-approved approach or road. Now, one of the gals talked about having to pave an area that she may just put gravel in or so forth. I've already got pavement on the side of our driveway, and it was there when we bought the house. The driveway was actually a mess, and we just replaced the cement that was already there. So I'm thinking, what if the people who owned the house before us did not get a permit to add that extra slab of cement to the right of our driveway where my trailer now sits? Would that be something that down the road I'd have to contend with? Would the city possibly say, hey, you know, back before you bought the house, that slab was not approved. Now you have to move your RV and rip out the slab and get a permit to put the slab back. Would I be permitted to put the slab back? Would I have trouble getting that permit? Those are some of the questions that I have. So I would like to have some clarification in that aspect to make sure that the slab it sits on is the slab that it's going to stay on. So anyway, thanks again so much for making these new regulations. I think there's going to be a lot of people that are very happy about it. And I think we're going to avoid a lot of problems with what do we do with 200 to 300 RVs in this town where there's really no place to park them, even in paid storage. So thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Dana Trout, followed by Scott Chang. And I may have mispronounced.
Clark.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Mr. Clark.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I echo the others in saying that I think that what's proposed is vastly improved, and I appreciate all the hard work that's been done on that. I will note that the first bullet point that's on the slide that's not showing yet is different than what was posted in the meeting notice on the web, so that kind of caught me a little bit flat-footed. But what I really wanted to speak about was the, as others have stated, the fourth point, which is require RVs to be parked on an approved driveway or other approved parking area with access provided via city-approved approach or yard. Now, I've seen quite a few people in our neighborhood and others have, back before the city was incorporated, got county approval. They put in concrete pads in their side yard, their backyard, their front yard, but they are not connected to the driveway, and there is no curb cut. There is no apron. What they use is a ramp. Temporarily, put the ramp down, drive the vehicle onto the pad, over the curb, onto the pad, pick up the ramp, scurry away with it, and so there's no impact on curb parking or anything. So the issue is, it seems like this fourth point is going to require that people either connect that pad to their current driveway, which quite often is on the other side of the lot. So, you know, you take out the whole front yard to do that, or get a new apron and curb cut for that pad. And I suspect that the city is not very interested in houses having two curb cuts and driveway aprons. So it just seems to put a lot of people at risk for they have something that is currently legal, has been legal for decades, and now suddenly they're going to be not in compliance. So I'd like you to look at that a little more closely. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Clark, followed by Jeff Waco.
Well, I wanted to thank you for that February 22nd meeting and, you know, listening to all the RV people and agreeing that we should make the restrictions a little less strict. I have an issue with bullet point 4.2 that requires the RVs to be parked on the approved driveway. My home's in the Crestview Terrace track. It was built in 1962 with a value of $14,700. The homes were built as cost-effective as possible, so a minimal driveway was normal. Driveway just goes straight up. Hundreds of people have added to the side of their driveways to make them more user-friendly and actually work. To actually back out of my driveway, I have to go in the area outside my original old concrete driveway to drive out of the driveway. So it would be more user-friendly. So my driver goes straight in, and hundreds of people in Goleta have added to the side of their driveway in gravel, decomposed granite. Some people have paved with concrete or asphalt. I mean, you can drive around and there are hundreds of homes, and there's boats parked on them. There's nothing parked on them. There's cars parked on them. So it's just like the driveway's here, and then people will take 6 or 8 feet and extend it. I don't know if mine was permitted or not. We bought the house in 95, and there was a carport over on the side. We had a zoning report. There was no zoning problems with it. you know, I just don't know if there's a permit. I went down to the city today to get the street file, and Goleta doesn't have the street file on my property because Santa Barbara lost it. So all I have is two permits on that property, one in 62 when it was built and one in 65 when the pool was built. And that's it. Now I have an appointment I'm going to go to the archives tomorrow to see what's really there, but I can bet you that, you know, when you're selling a house for $14,000, you don't spend a lot of money on a big driveway. So I don't know if it was permitted or not. I spoke with a Goleta building inspector today and was told that a driveway didn't require a permit. There was nothing to inspect, so it doesn't require a permit. So I'm just wondering, I'd just like to fine-tune this terminology, because this is going to affect almost all the RV owners. None of them have them directly in their little 8-foot, 10-foot driveways. They're usually off to the side. So my question is, what is an approved driveway? And how is it going to affect everybody? Because this current bullet point would disallow almost all the RVs parked at people's homes right now. They're, you know, I mean, you just drive around and look. You can see almost everybody's added to the side of their driveway. So I don't know. If there's no permit required, is mine legal nonconforming, or does anybody have an answer?
We're going to have that discussion once we're through all the public comment.
Okay. Let's see. Let me just go over this.
I think you are approaching your timeline, so.
Okay. That'll cover it. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff Waco, followed by G.S. Vanderman.
My name is Jeff Waco, and I represent my wife, our children, and my neighbors, and maybe some other people here. I'm not sure. I think so, maybe. We've been Goleta residents for 38 years and love our community and want to help make it better if we can. For starters, I want to commend the staff and the commissioners for all of the work you've been doing and for making the changes in the language that you have so far. I think a lot of people are really pleased with that. You know, the things we had asked for before were customary, habitual, and historical uses for our property, and I think for the most part you've honored that. I follow suit with a few other speakers where I think line 4 in the revised language, there's wording that I believe unfairly targets a certain segment of our community, and that's the RV owners. Like a few people have mentioned, I drove just two streets, and over 60% of the houses have extended their driveway in one way or the other, mostly to park other cars. And if you target RV owners only, that's unfair to those owners, while you still may allow it for people that park cars there. So I think that you would probably find the community to go along with all the changes that have been made as long as you strike line 4 out. I think that would probably be beneficial. It solves the problem of literally, like Scott said, hundreds and hundreds of extended driveways. It may solve the problem that Dana mentioned with people that have a pad that they can put a little wooden ramp and get up in and park. I think if you strike line 4 completely, you'll have good language. It covers the issues that I think everybody was concerned about. You know, people living in their vehicles, unregistered vehicles. I think you'll find that everybody will go along with it if you do strike out line 4. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. If you'd like to, yes. Okay, let's do that. Gary Vanderman, I'm assuming G.S. Vanderman, followed by Jay Newman.
Yes, thank you, Mayor Onan, members of the Planning Commission. Basically echoing almost everybody, starting with Mr. Fox. The general plan is an overview or a plan for the whole city. Specific neighborhoods differ. Some have uniform character, some have no character. I mean, how would you define Isla Vista? You know, but I think that what will be useful is for a local plan, which I would call a neighborhood residential preservation ordinance or overlay. This would guide changes to the neighborhood and make it much more coherent. We shouldn't go redeveloping a neighborhood that's already been developed. The general plan is for initial development. But once it's been developed, how are you going to control what happens afterwards? That's not clear. Second, RVs were not an issue 40 years ago. RVs, camper shells, fishing boats, water ski boats. These were minor visual issues. But there was a camel's nose under the tent. Nobody noticed what was happening. And suddenly we've got these house-sized vehicles parked and saying, well, wait, they're just RVs. You know, they're the same as a tent. Well, no, they're not. I think that it's an overwhelming impact now. We should treat them as a non-conforming use in terms of phasing them out of the residential neighborhoods. One thing I've noticed is that these vehicles become magnets for other vehicles, stuff, cans, trash, etc. And of course, the issue of property rights comes up. Everyone wants their property rights, but not too many people recognize their property responsibilities, the responsibilities to the neighbors. It is a community. We're all members of the community. Okay, and you need to be aware that when you impact your neighbors, it's not free. It isn't just you have your rights, you have responsibilities also. Thank you.
Thank you. Jay Newman, followed by Richard Thurston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commission, for allowing me to speak. I wanted to pretty much reiterate what you've heard here. I'm a boat owner, been here in Goleta for 25 years, and have it currently parked in the driveway. But again, when I read over the documentation here, the approval of the approved parking area statement, it needs clarification. You know, what does really constitute approval? You know, does it require a permit? You know, what are those grounds that we need to understand? I think that's really important. I think the other item too is, you know, is there a grandfather clause for people that have an existing situation so they don't have to tear it up? Those are all important issues that, you know, we'd appreciate if you could discuss to and explain to the public on what the definitions are. The other item, too, I wanted to touch on was, although it wasn't in this particular meeting, but we do have general verbiage in the earlier planning documentation that says that there's a generic statement saying goods and materials, you know, shall not be on the property unless they're covered or under cover under roof. And there, that general statement of, you know, goods and material could be just about anything. You know, it could be potted plant, could be bicycle or anything. So I just urge the board to address that language in an earlier session as well, just because sometimes when the statements are too general, they kind of broad brush a requirement that really isn't intended. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Thurston.
Yes, thank you very much. As you know, I'm Richard Thurston. I live in North Goleta on Carlo Drive, almost into our agricultural areas. I have a avocado grove within a block of my house, so we're very rural up there. This requirement to have the RVs parked on the original driveway will not work for a lot of people. You must remember that the houses in parts of the community were built 50, 60 years ago. And just in my neighborhood alone, there are driveways that are so narrow that they have to park their cars one behind the other, and the garage is straight ahead. My driveway is a little bit different but has a similar problem. It's very narrow, and once you get up there, it widens out so you can put your car in the garage or park it in front of the garage and have another car there. Without additional space, there's just a lot of us cannot park an RV anyplace as proposed in your wording. And what has happened in the meantime is, because of the age of the driveways, a number of people have had their driveways ripped up because they're just beyond usage. And so the new driveways were put in, and those that had RVs just added on to the driveway. It's still part of the driveway with the same pavement and everything. It's just made wider to accommodate their RVs, and that was done a number of times, including some of my close neighbors. So what I propose to the commission is that the requirement maybe would be that it be the RV would be parked on a suitable type of surface to accommodate the weight and of the RV. And that has to be my case because I widened mine with heavy-duty paver blocks that well exceed the carrying capacity of the weight of my RV. Thank you very much for all your work.
Thank you, sir. Okay, that is all of the public speaker slips that I have. Anything else, Madam Clerk? No? Okay. So we will move from public comment. And Ms. Wells, let me just ask you here. Did you want to address any of these issues specifically, or do you want to do this in the discussion, any of these points brought up during public comment?
I think that our presentation and discussion will address many of the comments made by public speakers.
Okay. That sounds good. Anything else from the commission, or are we ready to go with staff's presentation slide by slide? Go ahead, Mr. Daniels. Okay. Okay. So here we go. Ms. Wells, take us through this.
All right. Well, we are going to start with section 1739.070, RV parking and storage for residential uses only, which was the most popular topic of public comment tonight. On February 22nd, the Planning Commission reviewed the draft regulations that are in the public review draft zoning ordinance. Talked about things like allowed uses in the front setback, not blocking sidewalks. In addition, you know, we talked about paved areas versus not paved areas for parking, possibly requiring registration. We talked about, or you questioned, the size limit and screening that we have in the draft zoning ordinance. And then at the end, you requested that we return with an alternative. So that is what we did. We reviewed other jurisdictions in addition to some local jurisdictions. So that's in your packet. I think a takeaway is that it's not uncommon to regulate these specific standards. Two of the cities limited size. Two did not allow front setback parking, but they did. One did grandfather in the existing RVs that were parking in the front setback. It's very common to regulate the overhanging, the parking in approved driveways only, not for living. Some jurisdictions limit the number of RVs per unit. And so when we took a look at, there was another city not in your packet, but we found today had one about stormwater so that you're controlling your runoff so that it doesn't go into your neighbors. So there's a lot of things that cities can do to regulate recreational vehicles. So what we have proposed for you as suggestions that we thought would work for our city was to revise the provisions to include parking, allowing the parking in the front yard. So right now, the way it's written is not in the front yard. So we would suggest including the front yard. And I think there was a speaker who had a comment about the staff report. The staff report had some additional clarifications on the front yard setback, and it was becoming too complicated when it overlapped with another bullet. So we just simplified it for this presentation because it makes more sense to keep it not overlap, the bullets not overlapping with each other. And then prohibit RV overhang on property line or the public right of way. So this is important. This is already required in our municipal code. I just wanted to point that out. But I think it's good to be clear in these sections about things like overhangs. And then to require current RV registration. So that was a common tool that jurisdictions used. And I think it makes sense, too, so that it's not an abandoned vehicle, for example. And then the prohibit the use of any RV for on-site living purposes. Again, that would be in the public nuisance code. And then require that they be approved on an approved driveway or on other approved parking area with access via a city-approved approach or road. That way people are going up the existing ramps and not driving across a curb. And our streets are all kind of planned out around our, you know, the public right-of-way around where people are turning in or leaving a driveway. So that's why we thought that was important. And then removing the size and the screening regulations. That was a good one. Because that didn't seem to be working for our city. I also wanted to point out that our municipal code currently requires that RV parking in front yards be on pavement. It literally says on pavement. And so we're also, you know, we also have to work with what's currently in our municipal code. So I just wanted to point that out, that that's in effect now. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to you. You might want to go, either you could look at them all as a package, you can go over these bullets one by one, but your input would be great. Of course, nothing is locked down because we're going to return with a revised draft to you. You're going to make a recommendation. At the end of the day, is the city council who's going to decide this issue for our community. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Chair and Commissioner, with Ms. Carmen.
I would also like to add that there's been a lot of comments about approved driveway or approved parking area. The code does provide for what should constitute a parking area. It allows permeable paving, it allows the pavers that were mentioned by some, it allows paving, concrete. It would be what's appropriate for whatever vehicle you're parking. And it's the location of that is the issue. You can expand your driveway. Driveways that currently have expansions on the side setback, I can't say that they will universally be grandfathered because some of them could be in the right of way. But for the most part, those would be, they're existing. They're not going to be ripped out. You know, we wouldn't intend by this to make anyone change that. If you chose to rip it out, if it was declared nonconforming and you ripped it out, there are rules that may prohibit it to be reinstalled, but you're able to keep what you have. So I don't want, as part of this section, we don't typically add clarification on what a parking space should be. That's in a separate part of the parking rules. But we could add a reference back to that so someone can see that it can be concrete, pavers, whatever else could constitute a parking space. The right-of-way is an issue, and that goes with the overhang. So if there's a parking space that's in the right-of-way or if there's a car in the right-of-way, then it does raise some issues about, you know, needing extra permits or encroachments or anything like that. But the intent is if someone has an existing concrete driveway or parking pad for their space, these revised rules would allow that to remain. So,
and can you speak to the idea of there is there a permitting requirement under normal circumstances to pave over?
At this time, no. However, as Ms. Wells mentioned, stormwater. The county, actually the state, the rules are getting tighter and tighter and tighter about how much impervious surface you can have on your lot. And that goes to stormwater runoff and other things. And we have a lot coverage requirement that goes into, that gets to that. How many hardscape surfaces, or what's the percentage of hardscape surface that can cover your lot? So that's the only place where that could even come into play. But the most lots in this city, they're fine. But that's something that when you come into the counter and ask that question, a planner will sit down and go over all the rules with you, including parking areas, where your property lines are there any encroachments, how much, what's your lot coverage, pervious surface, all of those different rules. And it's just come in the door and we can walk you through it.
So one other overriding question here. So we haven't mentioned anything about safety concerns. The fact that side yard setbacks may be consumed by recreational vehicles, and there may not be access to rear yards for first responders. Mm-hmm. Will this come back around? Is this something that is going to be an issue with our fire people or something like that? And we even talked in some cases about multiple RV or recreational vehicles. You could conceivably have a recreational vehicle in both setbacks, which would significantly restrict access to the rear of the house. Any comment on that?
We will reach out to fire and get their opinions on this as part of our work in the overall the preparation of the public review draft or the public hearing draft, excuse me. Mm-hmm. But as of this date, we haven't had any input regarding that other than the comments that have appeared from the dais. So we'll
and we haven't had a fireman who's had an RV come and speak to us yet. We have? Okay.
We have.
Well, maybe they would be concerned with that.
Chair Onan, yes. I did want to point out that there, in your packet, there was one city that included a requirement for public safety. So they did, that city apparently felt that they needed to specifically call out safety. But just pointing that out, though, I think our municipal code also has other sections where public safety is mandatory.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Public safety, meaning we get approval from the public safety agencies, or
no, just the safety of the site and the site conditions is a priority.
Well, a valid neighborhood concern. If firefighters couldn't get back to somebody's yard to fight a fire, that would that translate to other properties? Obviously, a significant impact.
Right. So Fullerton, for example, is no threat to public health and safety. Is one of the requirements in their RV parking.
Which would accommodate making sure there was at least some side yard access. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm not trying to take up all this conversation time. Mr. Fuller, I saw you.
If I may, Chair, I want to revisit the approved versus permitted driveway or parking areas. So what would constitute receiving approval for a parking area if a permit's not required? I mean, if somebody comes in and says, this is where I want to park it, you know, and then they walk out and somebody told them at the counter, this is okay. And so somebody comes back, you know, 30 years from now and says, oh, you can't do that. And they're like, well, I went to the counter and they said it was fine. And versus, say, somebody puts in a driveway or parking area without a permit. Doesn't go to the counter, you know, and therefore is that not approved even though it otherwise meets all the requirements? I'd just like a little greater clarification for our public as to what that constitutes.
I guess that would you be Director Carmen that would get the answer.
That's an excellent question. And that actually, that's a question that would apply to most things that are permitted by right within the code. I think a lot of, a lot of homeowners want to, quote, do the right thing and come in and get checked to make sure their property is to code and there are no issues. But we recognize that in this community, we have antiquated codes. We have folks that have done things to their homes to improve them. That may not necessarily have required permits or they haven't come in and gotten permits. And that's something that we're dealing with now. And that's something that people deal with when they sell their house, which is why we find that a lot of people come into the counter to ask those questions because they do someday want to sell their home. and that's when things tend to pop up.
Okay, so essentially if somebody does it, you know, makes provision for parking of an RV, and well, there doesn't seem like there's very, very many restrictions. I mean, it has to be a surface that's paved, you know, mm-hmm. meets the paving requirements. So as long as they do that even on their own, because it doesn't require a permit, they've met the necessity to be approved.
Well, it could become a nuisance. It could become an encroachment issue. There are a number of things that could happen if they don't follow every single rule.
True. And if they, yeah. right, if they don't follow all the rules and it becomes to the attention of the city that they haven't, correct. Then they could become under an enforcement case.
Correct.
Is that right?
And, okay. And it could be code enforcement or it could be public nuisance. There's two. Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Maynard.
I have two items. One to follow up on this conversation. I believe, Director Carmen, that you mentioned that there was some specific language in the municipal code that said, for example, that we could do pavements or pavers mm-hmm. or some of the other things. So might it be more appropriate to say require RVs to be parked on a driveway that follows the municipal code rather than say to see approved?
Yeah, this isn't the exact language that yeah. we'll be in. This is yeah. a sampling of the provisions that we want to add in here. But, you know, as you take a, sadly for all of you, we're trying to make it simpler to read, but still when you write the code language, where it says allow RV parking, it ends up being a giant paragraph. So we would look at that, whether it says it could be RVs are to be parked on a driveway or other parking area subject to section whatever in mm-hmm. the parking chapter. So that type of reference. So exactly, we could pin it back over to where all the parking is. And in looking at our parking mm-hmm. section, I want to make a little bit stronger distinction, the types of parking surfaces that are allowed. Okay. It's not clear it's residential, mm-hmm. so we'll probably pull that out and make that a little clearer as well, that those are allowed.
Okay, great. I have some other follow-ups. Can you talk a little bit about the parking pads that are separated from the main driveway? So there's a number of public comments mm-hmm. about a parking pad that maybe to connect over to that, they have to put some plywood when they connect through. So what's the reasoning behind requiring that to be connected?
We don't require it to be connected through this. That's where we get into the legal nonconforming determinations.
Okay.
Because I think from the lot coverage standards, you wouldn't want a giant strip of, mm-hmm. well, not only lot coverage, but just aesthetics. You wouldn't want to put a giant strip of concrete down the front of your front mm-hmm. yard.
So I guess that with access provided via city-approved approach or road, that wouldn't prohibit those separated pads?
Well, that just because you can't, if you have a situation now mm-hmm. that the new code says you can't meet anymore, that's what creates the legal nonconformity.
Okay.
So when there's a situation, you can't prove it by permits. It's not a health and safety hazard, mm-hmm. But you know, something minor like that's a very easy call. Provided, I should say, it's not sitting in the right of way. Mm-hmm. There's not a health and safety issue. There's not a lot of things. I hesitate to talk about declaring mm-hmm. things legal nonconforming until we actually get to see them mm-hmm. on paper or see them in real life, just because mm-hmm. you just never know what the situation actually could be.
So. Sorry to keep pushing this, but just a little bit. So then, but in the future, you would have to have those pads connected. So this would only grandfather older spaces that are not connected?
Given the rest of the code that doesn't necessarily allow your entire front yard to be covered in concrete, yes.
Yeah, so it's
subject
it's,
to that.
Yeah, so in the future, it would be difficult to park your RV on the side or the back unless it was fully connected, but you're saying it would be difficult to fully connect because you can't cover that much of your
correct.
Driveway. That seems problematic to me. It seems like maybe we should be more open to these separated pads.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I had one other thing that I wanted to, before we get into some other discussion, mm-hmm. and Commissioner Foley, you brought this up after our discussion on the RVs, and I think the idea that really the existing use of side yard setback parking for IV for recreational vehicles mm-hmm. is not now a permitted use. It's not permitted in our current zoning ordinance.
No, well, this is interesting because a lot of people have brought up that when the existing neighborhoods have very short driveways, and the code that we brought over from the county doesn't allow any parking in your front setback, any, even your personal vehicles, because I think they were trying to encourage use of the garages through that. And when the neighborhoods were designed, short parking spaces would help with that idea of getting the cars off the street. If you're looking back at history and trying to figure out how codes were put together, mm-hmm. that may be one of the reasons why it was done that way. And the side yard area mm-hmm. is also your front. So in that corner where it's in your front yard and in your side yard, it's considered your front setback as well.
Does she craftily not answer my question?
Did I not answer the question?
The point was, it's not currently something, by practice, it's been done
absolutely.
In our
community. Absolutely.
And we recognize mm-hmm. that from public comment and from the surveys that have been done within our community. But it's not a by right allowance that was in the code. And it's just for our recognition of where our starting point is. It doesn't change the challenge, but it is worth that discussion.
So if I may, Chair, you're talking about side yard versus front yard setbacks, and you're speaking to both of them. Is that correct? Or
I am, yeah.
Okay. So neither of them, in the past, in our current code, allow for RV parking in our side yards as well as our front yard, or is it just excluded from front yard setbacks? Right?
Well, yeah, my understanding would be the side yard wouldn't be allowed to because it's a setback.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was something. So when the code first was being drafted, we during the module process, and we had talked about this during the last public meetings, we heard input about taking those types of vehicles out of the front setback, but also opening up the sides mm-hmm. to allow that. And then when we got a lot of public comment that most side setbacks aren't large enough to accommodate mm-hmm. the parking of those vehicles, and the front setback issues came up as well. Mm-hmm. And so now we're here. So.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, can I jump in?
Yes, please.
I just going through the bullet points. I'm okay with everything on here. It kind of boils down to that bullet number 4, in my opinion. And I'm just curious. Number 1, I think it'd be really helpful if...
You said 4? Is it?
Yeah, item 4. Let me just finish that thought. So I would suggest that the way it's written right now, it says requires RVs to be parked on approved driveway or other approved parking area with access provided via city-approved approach or road. It's number 4 in this guy.
Okay,
it's number 5 in this guy.
Yeah.
I would suggest that we say RVs require RVs to be parked on an approved surface, period. Remove the issue about approach and driveway. And my reasoning for that is I don't want to see a bunch more curb cuts. I don't want to see, because that's going to take street parking away as well. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of applications where a homeowner has an RV parked on a surface that can support the weight of the vehicle. And clearly they're driving across their front lawn, going over some blocks or ramp or something over the curb to get to the street. And to me, I think it's a happy solution. It meets, it's a rarity to drive over it. It's parked out of the front yard, in some of the situations, even out of the front yard setback. So that's my suggestion for language for that bullet. And then also, I think it'd be really helpful as, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe a circular or some type of diagram that would give the public, similar to our other parking diagrams we have through the ordinance, to suggest, okay, here's a bird's eye view of your lot. Here's some suggested locations for where we see parking should work. And I think we could address side yard issues, emergency access. I'd hate to see an RV parked in front of an exit window from a bedroom. Someone can't even get out, And I think if you had a vehicle parked in the side yard for one, you shouldn't have one parked on the other side yard. So maybe I'd love the fire department to weigh in on this. I don't know if we could indulge them, but if we had one side yard gobbled up and we had one side yard available, is that sufficient? So anyhow, that's my two cents.
Okay, so Mr. Fuller, I'm going to come to you, and then we're going to come back and we're going to go point by point.
Okay.
And make our comment on. So hold on, I'm going to go to Mr. Fuller, and then I'm sure you're going to be able to make any comment you want during that process. But we have some input that they're looking for us here, and I know we could discuss this issue for a long time, trying to really get down to the fine points, but I think we just need to give them a certain amount of input and then wait for the revised draft and see if we're happy with it. Mr. Fuller.
So I just wanted to suggest that instead of approved, that we say meeting current zoning requirements.
Okay.
And then the onus will be upon the owners to, you know, meet those requirements, as opposed to, you know, getting some sort of, you know, sign off or something. And if they don't, well, it can be enforced. And if they do, well, it's great. You know, no permit was required.
Okay. So we're going to go back to the slide, because everybody's looking at this slide and the public is looking at this slide. So let's start with bullet point number one. And this is going to kind of be like a page turn. Yes.
So my only question is, I'd like to introduce a new bullet point. So can you let me know when I can suggest that?
Is it going to override or connect to existing bullet points?
No.
Well, then let's do it at the end.
Okay.
Okay. So allow RV parking storage in any yard area. This is simplification from what we saw in the staff report. Anybody have a comment on that item, or do we find... Yes, Commissioner Fuller.
In looking at the other ordinances and other communities, an idea that I thought was really good was that the RV or boat should not be parked parallel with the front of the house. So you don't end up with, you know, like a 35-foot yeah. RV, you know, totally blocking the front of the house.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard.
Clarification on that. I'd support that if you're talking about within the driveway, but then my question is, would that prohibit parallel parking along the front of the house? I know that's temporarily done. Somebody made it in public comment. They talked about a temporary permit for parking parallel in front of the house.
I think it meant on the street.
Yeah, but so would that prohibit the street, or that's only within the driveway?
Well, if you get a permit, you have a permit. So
for the street, okay.
Yeah.
Then I would support that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to play devil's advocate, we do have a lot of side entry garages in the city. So you drive up and then you turn sideways. Mm-hmm. And if you're parked in front of your drive or in front of your garage door, you are parallel parked in front of your house. So
the front of the house, yeah. Not the front of the driveway.
Well, the front of the house.
Yeah, the house still goes like this. The garage goes like this, the house goes like this, right? So this is the front of the house.
Well, the garage, if the garage...
Well, let me just say, I do have concerns whether or not that's enforceable.
Yeah.
The parallel.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I agree. So okay. That's where I was headed.
So any other comments on this first bullet point from the slide?
I'm fine with it.
Commissioner Jenkins, Commissioner Daniels?
I'm fine with bullet point one. Thank you.
And Commissioner Maynard, you were fine with that?
Yes, and I believe we're not doing the parallel now. Is that correct?
It's
not adding
like
language.
That's in question.
Okay.
Commissioner Fuller, anything else?
Nothing else.
Okay. We're going to go to the bullet point number two, prohibit RV overhang on property line or public right of way. Commissioner Fuller, anything on that?
Nope.
Commissioner Maynard? Commissioner Daniels, anything on the second bullet point? Property line or public right of way?
I'm confused on it. It's saying that an RV overhang. What's that mean?
The RV cannot intrude into the public right of way.
Oh, sure. Okay. Thank you. Bullet point number two, I'm with. Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
I have no problem with it.
All right. And I have none either. So let's go. Commissioner Daniels, we're looking at require current RV registration.
I believe you would need to get that. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Jenkins?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I'm just
curious with regards to planned non-operative, you know, because the DMV has your, you know, you can tell the DMV you're not going to be operating a vehicle for 5 years or whatever it is. So is that contrary to the intent of this?
And Commissioner Fuller?
I guess that point is that require operable registration as opposed to storage registration. So,
Commissioner Maynard? And my comment follows Commissioner Jenkins in that I think what we're trying to do is accomplish some condition of the RV by having it being able to be registered. And as you said, a non-operating registration has basically no requirements. You can park anything. It could not have wheels or anything on it.
Yeah.
I think we're not writing out the whole regulation, just more of the gist of it.
Okay.
Right. I think you're right. It is. I think it's fair to ask that question. It's operable, unexpired, so that it's
Streetworthy.
Maybe it's a condition as well as addressing the condition of the RV. I think you're attempting to address the condition of the vehicle.
I think so that fluids and things aren't just leaking out or what, it's just not been properly abandoned.
Yeah, but people drive them on the road with fluids leaking out of them.
It'd be a little hard to regulate.
We're still trying to create a condition of the vehicle, and I don't know that the requirement for registration fulfills that. That's my concern with that one. Yes, Commissioner Maynard?
I'm concerned about enforceability, so I support Vice Chair Jenkins' initial request here that it is a current RV registration for operable use. It doesn't perfectly fit the situation, but it's enforceable.
it seems so sticky to me because people have the right to have a non-operating registration on a vehicle. You have that right in California. I think what we're trying to accomplish here is a condition of the vehicle, and we're using the registration as a method to do that, and that may not accomplish it, and in fact may allow what we're trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. It's more about if it's operating condition. Of course, that's subjective, but I'm just not comfortable with that as accomplishing what we're trying to do here.
Chair, if I could clarify, so we go back to the definition of a recreational vehicle and what its intended use is for. So if it's just sitting there and it's abandoned, then it's an abandoned vehicle. It's not a recreational vehicle. So then it's going to be subject to something different. In a residential zone isn't a place for abandoned vehicles. Mm-hmm. So that's how you would look at it, is you go back always to that. What's the definition?
Okay, we don't seem to be effective in getting abandoned vehicles off of people's property either, because we see those in a variety of places. It becomes a real eyesore for the neighborhood. So I guess we throw that back to you. Figure that one out.
I think we understand what the point is you're trying to.
So we're going to the next item, which is prohibit use of any RV for on-site living purposes. Commissioner Maynard, any reservations there? Commissioner Fuller?
No.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yeah, just from the standpoint of an emergency situation, you know, post-earthquake aftermath, you know, it's a lifeboat for some people. So in that situation, I think you should be able to live in it.
Well, I don't know if anybody will be around to enforce it.
I sure hope they will.
Yeah, so maybe some clarification. Mr. Daniels, anything on that bullet point?
Commissioner Jenkins had a good point, and let's see if we can get the wording right on this one.
Maybe to prohibit full-time residents of it, something, but... Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the issue of occupancy while your home is being remodeled is a very good point as well.
Yeah, there's another chapter
Yeah. I was thinking specifically emergency situation. You know, it's not the in-law coming to town, but, you know, obviously maybe that's maybe that is an emergency for some families.
Okay, Commissioner Maynard.
This has brought up some good conversation here. So I guess that's the other question that I have. If a visitor comes for a short time, would they be able to stay in the RV? I think that they should be able to. If you've got, how would you regulate living purposes? So, for example, many people use RVs for living purposes when they're not at their house. So that facility is going to have a microwave. It's going to have a shower. It's going to have a number of amenities. So if somebody inspected the RV, they would see it as a living space, but it's not being used as a living space when it's at the house. It's being only used as a living space on travel. Does this language prohibit that? So I think maybe something like I like the language of prohibit use of an RV for full-time living purposes.
It's for any, right now the way it's written, it's any on-site living purpose, with the exceptions of the emergency or if it's during a construction period. Okay. This came up during the original discussions. We do have Airbnb situations. We have rental situations. We have other things that have been reported. And so that was the, you know, as we're looking at how do you determine that it's really a recreational vehicle and not a mobile home or trailer that someone's living in, let's throw this in here. And that's sort of where that came from.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe add language that it should not be rented to, you know, rented on site.
Okay, so did everybody get a weigh in on that one?
I'd like to say something.
Yes, Commissioner Daniels.
I think you might want to say something like, you know, except for when, and then you have your citations. And you were about to, you know, you were telling me about some citations in here that work. So can we throw those couple in if you got them?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Yes, Commissioner.
So I just would, you know, speak in favor of highly restrictive on-site living purposes. That's, you know.
Yeah, I think this language should include identifying that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's go to the item that we've had a lot of discussion already about. This is the driveway conditions. And Commissioner Jenkins already had proposed some language there. Would you repeat that for us?
Sure. Just that we simplify it simply by going RVs, require RVs to be parked on approved surface or on appropriate surface. Period.
Commissioner Maynard?
I would also just recommend the direct reference to the code that delineates what those appropriate surfaces are. And I support the idea that you should be able to access pads that are separate from the main driveway.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I think I said my piece.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, anything else? No. Commissioner Daniels, anything on that one?
I'm in favor with what Commissioner Jenkins said. Thank you.
So we would have public nuisance or health and safety and welfare kind of ways of dealing with a negative issue from, you know, like we said, rainwater runoff, where it's collapsing, sinking, those kind of, so there is a way to deal with this within the code, not in this specific section. I have no other comments. All right, so we're going to this last item before Commissioner Maynard is going to give us another bullet point. Remove any RV size limitations and screening requirements. Comments on this one?
Just that I support the language as is.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm okay with it.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yeah, I'm okay with it. I understand why we removed the screening because, yeah, you know, 6 foot wasn't going to do it.
Yeah,
so,
right,
you know, just take it away. So.
Commissioner Daniels? Anything on that?
We're talking about you know, liking the last bullet point, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Please.
Okay. And I have no comment there. So, Commissioner Maynard, you had another bullet point for consideration.
Just in heart of looking at that, there's a quite two different sides to this issue. There was one other point that was made in one of the public comment letters, and a suggestion from one of the other cities that I think might address it. Huntington Beach had an additional requirement that the recreational vehicle should be free from trash. One of the public comments was a belief that RVs can attract some additional waste outside of the home. So maybe we should consider adding some language that, similar to what Huntington Beach has, that the RV should not have trash surrounding it.
Okay. So I think that gives, that addresses the bullet points. If there's no other comments, let's move on to the next item.
Sorry, actually, can I clarify one thing? When I say trash, I mean litter as opposed to a trash bin.
Okay. All right. So, Ms. Wells, can anything you want to go through on 17.41 signs? I think that's our next slide.
So when we previously discussed signs at a public workshop, we talked about the content of sign. There was a discussion throughout the conversation on signs, on sign content. And we just wanted to reiterate that the sign content is there's restrictions because of court cases and then also freedom of speech. So when we prepared the draft ordinance, we tried to be content neutral on the signs and stick with the when, where, and the how. And not regulate that content. Noting, though, that, and we previously had discussed this, that pornographic and vulgar content is regulated by separate laws that that our community is subject to. So those are already in effect. We don't recommend making any changes to the sign based on just this particular item. We just wanted to make sure that you were aware that we were sensitive to the sign content and the court cases and the freedom of speech, for example, and that was the lens from which we were looking at crafting the regulation. So if that's all right with you, then we just wanted to make sure that we were clear on that.
Mm-hmm. Would anybody like to make any comments on this 17.41? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Commissioner Maynard.
So I note that in the current draft zoning ordinance, we do have a number of prohibited signs. For example, cabinet or can signs are prohibited. Mobile billboards are prohibited. So why is it that we can't restrict the electronic copy signs, but we can prohibit cabinet or can signs?
It's a point of order, Mr. Chair. This is talking about content.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sign content.
So we will,
not the
text. Okay. Yes, we will get to that issue.
Okay.
We will get to that issue.
Okay.
Yes, please.
But this content specific, and thank you for that, Commissioner Jenkins.
Okay.
We did have some discussion about this when we went through the sign, mm-hmm. and staff's just bringing back and explaining where that language was coming from. So do we have anything specifically to these content-related issues? Okay. I don't see anything, so let's go to 17.41. We're still in signs, and now we are into electronic changeable copy signs. And Ms. Wells, did you want to lead us through this slide before we start our discussion? Because I think there's a couple things in here that changed.
Yes, yeah, so we do have some new things in here that are relating to electronic changeable copy signs. And it has to do with emerging case law on scrutiny when there's prohibitions on an entire category of signs. Mm-hmm. So its own, for example, its own section in our sign ordinance for mm-hmm. electronic changeable copy. Mm-hmm. Right now, the draft, the way it's written, is to only allow these types of signs for fuel price signs. And then public or semi-public uses and indoor theaters. So it's use related, not district related. There is a 400 foot
frontage.
Street frontage where the main building is set back at least 20 feet from the property line. And there are not that many parcels that that applies to in the city. So it has to be a pretty long, big parcel. And so those are generally in the huge, you know, like the Camino Reals, and then some of the bigger parcels in Old Town and the industrial, where there's more industrial type uses. So that 400 foot serves as a limiting factor, but it doesn't completely restrict anywhere where where these types of signs are allowed. But where I did want to, we do have limitations. So they're not just allowed anywhere with that 400 feet. There's also size and the number of these types of signs, the brightness, the duration of the display, and then it has to go to design review. We're not getting them now, except for at the gas stations. But speaking of the brightness, we had talked at one of our meetings about our measurement, and we are talking about changing that. And so we wanted to make you aware of the light intensity. So we want to change it to reflect 0.3 foot candles over ambient lighting conditions. So this is more true to how it's used in the other sections of the sign chapter, plus adding things in like a sensor that automatically dims or that can be adjusted to comply with the 0.3 foot candle measurement. So that's what we're talking about, how we're talking about changing this section. We heard you, we went back to the drawing board and we saw that one section on the foot candles in particular needs to be modified. And so we're asking for your input on that, but then also on the display duration. So we discussed display duration. Right now it's a pretty short, well, it's all relative, but it's intended that if you're driving by, you can see a change. And so we're talking about changing it from 4 to 8. If we go too much, it's very subjective, but if you go too much further than that, then it takes a long time for them, you know, relatively speaking, for a shift if you're driving by. So that's why we thought 8 seconds was a good measure for us to set for a regulation.
Okay. You've taken us through your points.
Mm-hmm.
All right, back to the commission. Should we go down this list again, point by point? I think first of them are informational about case law. Allows electronic copy size fuel signs. Item number 2 is the public and semi-public uses indoor theaters. So we obviously have had discussion and comment from the public about concerns in semi-public uses. So opportunity to comment on. Mr. Fuller,
unfortunately, I read this section 17.41.040A rather quickly, and I've now noted that it does allow. It seems like we have a prohibition on the less attractive forms of signs, except when they're an LED sign. So I don't understand why we should allow LED signs to do things that we don't allow other signs to do, other than, say, holiday lights. So, you know, blinking, flashing, shimmering, glittering, rotate, oscillating, moving, whether it's some physical sign that does that, some, you know.
That would still be prohibited as part of a digital sign.
But it says right here that it's this provision does not apply to signs using digital display technologies such as LED.
And we would want to go back and take a look at that and
please
add a static, you know, so a sign that would sit, one of these changeable signs, it would be just like one of these slides, not all those words, but it would flash and then 8 seconds later, another one would come up, but you couldn't.
That's completely different than what this is describing.
Yes, and we're going to go back and take a look at that.
Okay, please.
Because yeah, what was brought up, Ms. Brown brought up a number of times, was the LED, the old school LED sign that's at the fairgrounds, mm-hmm, where the letters move and it's very distracting. That was never the intent of the changeable copy. It was the newer LED signs that look more like a small sign that just changes. It's not, doesn't flash, it doesn't have things moving around. And I recognize that we do need to go back and take a look at that language.
Well, you know, LED signs essentially are TVs or potentially TV screens that, you know, can have any form of graphics that are computer generated. Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, you can create the display of a commercial on them, you know, just a 60-second commercial.
It's true.
So, but that would sort of fall in the blinking, flashing, shimmering, glittering, rotating, oscillating, moving, you know, category. So that's why I prefer
right.
to have
and,
it all prohibited.
And with the emerging case law, we're able to look at cities that do have the very they allow them. So we're not prohibiting the entire type,
sure.
but
LEDs
you can
okay.
regulate the type of advertisement that's on them. Okay. So
right.
All right. Any other comments here, Commissioner Maynard?
Sorry, to go back to my question that was a little out of turn before. So just so I'm fully understanding this, why is it that the can or cabinet signs are, we can prohibit that as a category, but not the electronic changeable signs as a category? I'm not sure if I'm fully understanding that legal restriction.
The can signs isn't... it's not a new type of signage. It's a sign type or genre, but it's not. So you have LED signs, and then you have material signs,
okay.
and so that's a type of material sign that is not attractive, not or as the aesthetic is not. I don't know, Mr. Architect, help me here. Traditionally, that has been a type of sign that has not been preferred within the city. It's actually, can signs tend to be not prohibited, discouraged in a lot of cities. Mm-hmm. They're, because there are newer, more attractive, more energy efficient signs that don't glow the same way, rear lit, backlit, mm-hmm. All of those different types tend to be more the things that are preferred. We wouldn't allow a sign type, or we would try and keep a sign type out of the fray if we know it will be, if we know it will never be approved by the DRB. Mm-hmm. And this is one type that we pretty much know would be discouraged or mm-hmm. ask for a different type of sign at the DRB, mm-hmm. as with most cities' design.
And can you talk just a little bit about why you chose to focus on use rather than the zone? So public, semi-public uses rather than by residential versus commercial? Because I'm not sure that I'm fully understanding that. My preference would be to only see these in commercial zones.
One reason we thought of that, because introducing these signs, we want to meet, we don't want to put the city in a vulnerable place mm-hmm. by prohibiting them completely. But you also don't want to have open the gates completely and allow them everywhere because of the concern over digital mm-hmm. signage. So the idea was that a school, a church, an indoor movie theater, and gas stations would be the only ones allowed to have them.
Okay.
Whereas if you open it up to commercial, then every single thing on Calle Real mm-hmm. could have one.
Okay.
Or every single use on Hollister could have one.
Okay.
And then you end up with a large proliferation of those types of signage. So that was, I think, yep. the motivation by mm-hmm. doing it by use, with the recognition that, you know, if you have, for example, you know, either the theaters can mm-hmm. put an LED sign with mm-hmm. the movies that they have on display, the school mm-hmm. could put something up that, and some of them already do have mm-hmm. that. And I that was just where the motivation was coming from, to open the gates just yeah. a little, but not completely.
And could we legally restrict it to residential and keep the public, semi-public uses, the language you have here in the second bullet point? Could we do both?
No.
Okay.
Because the public, semi-public uses are in residential zones.
And it is its own zone.
Yeah, okay, I mean, so they can't overlap.
That example is, okay. I didn't understand why you chose that example, but now as we're having this discussion, it is a kind of mm-hmm. a classic example, right? You mm-hmm. have schools mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. residential areas,
mm-hmm.
and that have you know, the sign requirement and the utilization of a sign, specifically the, you know, information for those, mm-hmm. in most cases, the parents, mm-hmm. You could imagine that use being attractive if they could afford to get a sign like that, a digital copy-changing sign that would allow them to communicate information to their constituency mm-hmm. on an ongoing basis, timely. Example actually helps me understand it. I am concerned with all the other impacts that we've discussed and the public has brought up.
Mr. Chair, I kind of view that Elwood school sign. That's the box sign. That's the can sign you're talking about. So that is.
Is it? It's not backlit. Is it lit?
That certainly could be backlit. I mean, if that's like a movie kiosk, it's backlit.
Okay, I didn't see it as that.
But, well, I'm seeing it as that, and from the standpoint that I think Ms. Brown mentioned some churches, and I don't recall if Kellogg School has a backlit sign. I know they do have a changeable copy sign right in the front. Mm-hmm. But if it is backlit, then it is emanating light, okay? Versus if it's a changeable copy sign, it's the light emanation is only from the pixel of the letter, all right? So it seems to me that that would be emanating less light than a backlit can, which I'm interpreting that to be what that is. Oh. So to prevent glowing from happening. So I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm also hearing what Ms. Brown is saying, is that we don't want, you know, flashing signs in neighborhoods. So, you know, if it's a changeable copy sign that only changes every 8 seconds, I can live with that if the luminaries is such that it's not going to spill over onto homes and create a nuisance, you know.
Thank you. It's
an aesthetic thing, mm-hmm. and
that is exactly what we were when we were going back and looking at the foot candles and the wording to make sure that it addresses the concern that you have, and we share that concern. And I think and also we went and mapped out looked at the parcels with 400 feet of frontage, and it will be included. That map will be included in the environmental impact report response to comments. Mm-hmm. So that we have a better understanding of where those parcels are, and how there may or may not be any kind of residential concern. So I think we're on the same page, and we're on a path to adding clarity and making sure that sign lighting issue is resolved, and including some metering and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And we can also include hours of operation. Although given the electrical usage of it, I would guess that people, you know, you turn off the lights, you turn off everything in those public and semi-public uses, not gas stations per se, but we can add that as well. And in particular for those uses, we could limit the time on it as well.
Commissioner Fuller.
Thank you. And so I think one of the distinctions that we have here is the difference between illuminated signs, which are illuminated from sources that are directed towards the sign, versus signs that emanate light, and that we should have probably a certain distance for signs that emanate light from residential areas, maybe. And, you know, they can still have a sign that's illuminated, because if the light is all directed at the sign, then it's essentially blocking, mm-hmm. you know, the unless there's some reflection, it's essentially blocking the light. But if it's emanating light, then it's providing, it's a source of light, and it's, you know, therefore going off into the atmosphere and maybe the neighbors as well. So maybe having a distance for emanating signs from residential areas doesn't mean that they can't have an illuminated sign, but you just, that might help in this situation.
Commissioner Maynard?
I would, because cabinet and can signs, though there are some grandfathered uses, are not allowed moving forward. I do think we should be comparing this to, as Commissioner Fuller was talking about, the ones where the light is directed towards the sign, and to see if this is a good comparison to that. One question that I've got, can we restrict them in scenic corridors? Question for staff.
Thank you. Well, when we work on these revisions, many of what we're discussing here are things that we've been seeking to resolve, and I think we're on the same page.
Okay. So I support restrictions in scenic corridors and restriction to operating hours, and as far as bullet point two is concerned.
Okay. Any other comments on this slide? I think we've worked through this from what I've heard, but I don't want to leave anybody not having a chance to make a comment here. Commissioner Maynard, anything you wanted to add?
Just to make sure that the variance between appropriate amount of light during the day versus appropriate amount of light during night is considered, and the ability to automatically have that change from day to night was something that I wanted to take a look at. Also support the language of potential lighting setbacks from neighboring properties to make sure that there's not spillover.
Any other comments on this slide?
Not at the slide per se.
Okay.
I made a comment back I don't know, a month ago or so when we had this in front of us. And asked why it's not part of the Sun Committee, and why it has to be part of the Planning Commission. They've got their guidelines already, don't they? And we've seen them, didn't we? But you know, it's difficult for me to think that DRB doesn't have a role in the signs. And I mean, that's what others do, you know. Yes, we'll take you know, anything on appeal, but you know, it's I'm just wondering where that went.
So. You're exactly correct. That design review board is going to see the sign.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Thank you.
All right. But I'm glad you raised that point, because I think that's important, not just for you all, but for the public that's listening to, that they're aware that Design Review Board will be seeing the signs.
Commissioner Jenkins, were you okay on that one?
I'm fine.
Okay. So why don't you look at 17.41, signs, nonconforming signs, 41.120. That's our next slide. Ms. Wells, did you want to... comment anything here before we get into the discussion?
No, just wanted to point out, because we did have a detailed conversation at a previous workshop on nonconforming signs, that when, because we do have situations where there's a lot of, like in this photo, that's common in areas of the city, where there's signs that are in nonconformance with the existing regulations and also would be with the draft if they were adopted. And then what do you do in those situations? And so what we have concluded is that the courts are kind of ruling in this area that new owners can change the copy, so change out their name, but they're not mandated to bring the signs into conformance. So we just wanted to clarify that with you right now. That's what we're looking at. If they're coming in to do a bigger change to the building or to the windows, that would be a different story. But just because they're changing the ownership doesn't mean that they have to fix the nonconformities.
Okay. Any comments on this one?
Yeah.
Commissioner Jenkins?
What if the use changes? What if it goes from car dealership to flower sales?
That's a different situation.
Is it? Okay, so that we could impose them to change, you know, go with conforming sign.
Just like if a business is abandoned, mm-hmm. then the sign non-conforming sign rights would also fall under the non-conforming code as far as losing rights to the signs as well.
So if a new owner comes in and it's exactly the same use, they can fly under the non-conforming sign?
Right. For example, if the business in the picture on the slide, mm-hmm. If owners changed, we wouldn't make the new owner upgrade the signage.
Okay.
Even though you might wish they would.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, too, just from the standpoint of eminent domain and things like bluff erosion and you know, that we've determined you can't rebuild your home, you know, if because of a situation. So that's a big imposition, but yet we don't have the ability to ask someone to go conforming if it's a new owner.
But if the business changed,
yeah.
and let's say went to the flower shop, but they needed all new signage, that would need to conform. But if you have a business with existing signage where only the ownership is changing but not mm-hmm. the use,
okay.
then you wouldn't necessarily make them change everything.
I understand it. Thank
Do
you.
Do we have some provisions yeah. for the 50% of sign
Oh, that's if it fails. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the right. that's the better analogy.
We do have a mechanism.
Yeah, that's thank you. That's the better analogy.
To bring
yeah.
some signs into
yeah,
conformance
you're right.
rather than just being rebuilt.
Yeah.
Commissioner Maynard?
I believe so this is related but not exactly on the slide. I was looking at your tables, and in the DRB suggested draft sign regulations, there was some additional language about non-conforming signs and sort of the amortization process. Is that now in the municipal code, and so that's not why it's in the zoning code? Or can you talk a little bit about where that language for the DRB had originally suggested, where that went?
It never went anywhere. That's why the okay. DRB representatives who brought that forward have brought mm-hmm. it back now, because they'd mm-hmm. like to see it. So as part of the preparation of the public mm-hmm. hearing draft,
yeah.
we are using those comparison tables yeah. to sort of blend everything in to see what actually works. So we can't tell you right now whether mm-hmm. or not that will be included, but we are doing a thorough mm-hmm. review of that okay. 2004, our existing mm-hmm. and our proposed, to make sure everything mm-hmm. works together.
And if we wanted that language, would it be most appropriate to integrate into the zoning ordinance or the municipal code?
It would be in the zoning ordinance, but okay. I think it would be best in the nonconforming section.
Okay.
And dealing with nonconformities altogether.
Okay.
And we already do have some language there now regarding that.
Thank you for that clarification.
They created quite a meaty enforcement mm-hmm. in that document, if you read through that. You understand what they're trying to accomplish, but it's like, whoa. that's going to be a difficult one mm-hmm. to go to that level. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to read that. Mm-hmm. Yes, Commissioner Ford.
Thank you, Chair. So just to be really clear, you say if the use changes, but what if it's a, you know, we defined our uses such as a retail store. So if it's still a retail store that goes from flowers to auto parts, then it's not really a change of use, is it?
If they're changing the sign copy.
Yeah, they just change
the sign. So they can continue to use the same, say, can sign that's been there. They don't have to bring it into current requirements. They can change the copy. So there may not be that many instances when the signs will be required to be brought up to conforming standards, you know, unless the use falls outside of our predetermined types of uses. Is that correct?
Well,
our definitions of uses.
Correct. Car accessories, flowers, both retail uses.
Right.
Let's say they have a can sign where you slide in and slide out the business name.
Right.
As much as we'd like to see that can sign go away, they could just slide the business name in and move on with their day. They want something different, then they go through the process and upgrade it.
Okay.
If it was a sign that, let's say, it was a carved wood sign that exceeded the size limits for the business, and they needed to completely change the name. And there was no way they could use what was actually there. That new sign would need to conform.
They couldn't recarve the wood?
They couldn't recarve the wood into the word that they wanted, yes.
Okay. So lastly, because we have a nonconforming use ordinance, couldn't the city actually decide individual signs are nonconforming and then put them on notice and use the nonconforming use section of our zoning code to force them to change the signs?
No, because we have nonconforming use, we have nonconforming parking, and we have nonconforming sign. And nonconforming structure. So there's four sections in that code. So
right, but nonconforming structures is also part of it, and a sign is a structure.
No, it's a sign.
It's a sign. All right.
All right. Any more comments on this? Did you get enough feedback there?
I think so.
Okay. Great. So we're on now the next slide, 17.42.090, community assembly. This should be relatively easy for us to do. Did you have anything you wanted to lead us off with, Ms. Wells?
Yes, we spent some time talking about community assembly and the hours restriction that is in the draft. And without going into too much detail because it's in your packet, it's also expressed up on the slide. Because community assembly includes religious assembly, we're kind of obligated to look at the least restrictive means of regulating religious assembly. And so we suggest that we just eliminate the hours of operation for the city. And we think it makes sense for the city to not have those hours of operation.
Okay. Any comments on this slide? See anything? No. Good. We'll move on to the next one. Design review. Okay. I think you should lead us through this.
Yes. So what we did was in your packet, in your staff report, there's the DRB minutes that talk where they are discussing design review. Board members are talking about the design review chapter of the new draft zoning ordinance. And so in the presentation, we broke down some of their comments into the things that we think that we really need to hear back from you on. And so the first one is what is a question to you, whether or not you support sending all new non-residential standalone landscaping projects to DRB and all non-residential re-landscaping projects visible from the city right away to DRB. And as you can see on the screen, that the current practice is all new non-residential go to DRB, but the re-landscaping are determined by staff. And we don't have this detail in the regulation, and we would like to add it in. But we do think that that's the approach that we have outlined here.
Chair, may I?
Please.
I had asked for this to be also in the hands of DRB. You've got so many metrics in the landscape plan. I would make sure that if you're going to keep all those metrics, all of those numbers, you know, that if they need to conform to what is in the zoning ordinance, shouldn't it be them that has those metrics instead of us? I'm just speaking off the top of my head, but it sounds more reasonable that, you know, they've got the guidelines, is what I understand, and, you know, we should, in the signs and in the landscaping, we should have those in some kind of conformity. So, you know,
The board has looked at the design review chapter. I spent a good, I want to say 2 hours with them, going through a page turn of the design review section and having a pretty detailed discussion, which is in the minutes. And there was a lot that came out of that discussion, some really good comment. So in regards to this particular question, the idea was, and they weren't completely, there wasn't a majority either way. I think they also wanted to kick this back to you and say, should it be, should things that are visible from city right-of-ways come to the DRB? If there was something that you couldn't see from the street, would that be okay that staff would deal with that or administrative design review would deal with that? I think everyone agreed that new non-residential standalone landscaping projects should go to the board because those do change the look of a building. With the re-landscaping that we're seeing, a lot of times it's for drought tolerant plant conversion. They're trying to do better with their water. They're looking at the water efficient landscape ordinance. They're doing different things with that. And so it's really looking at, should it be visible from right-of-ways, go to DRB or not? And, my personal opinion is that, we were leaning in the direction of let's just go that way, but they really wanted to get some input from the commission as well. So,
Commissioner Jenkins, I'm going to start with you on that. After Mr. Daniels. So what do you say?
Well, I was going to ask staff's recommendation on it, honestly, was what I was going to ask. But, if it's total redesign of landscaping, then it should be reviewed is kind of my default. So if staff determines that, it's a minor change and maybe it gets a pass, I'm okay with that too. But I want consistency and I want appropriateness for every applicant. So maybe the best thing is for it to go back to DRB. I can't speak to the DRB's workload. I can't speak to what this would do to them, as far as their dockets and all the rest. So I want to be sensitive to that too. So.
But as a general, in a general philosophical perspective, if you can see it from a public street, you would want it to go to the board.
I can support
if
that.
It's a minor, if it's a re-landscaping project to the rear of a building that no one sees but the users of that building, does that need to go to DRB?
I would give them a pass.
Note that anytime staff is looking at something, they do consult with the DRB chair if there's questions, and it can be elevated up to the board. So we would still include that function as well.
Comments here?
So I think a full landscape that's visible should, re-landscape should go back to the full DRB, and not visible should be a ministerial approval.
Commissioner Maynard?
I support what's been said.
Okay. And I'll just comment that I definitely want to have a ministerial or a non-DRB ability to deal with landscaping. I get the idea from public right-of-way, but visible could be very small or very significant. So I just want to make sure that we're not overdoing this one to that everything has to go through the DRB. Obviously, significant cost and time for an applicant to go through that, and if we do that, overdo that, they will not go through our process, or they'll be suffering unusual cost and delay. So I think there needs to be an administrative method to go through some of the options as well. All right, let's go to the next one.
Chair?
Yes.
I've got something to say.
Sure.
I apologize for not reading your design review chapter, because you put in here DRB. Thank you very much. So you were already thinking about it, and I apologize for my discussion. Now, I don't apologize for my discussions, but I apologize for having to say all of that again.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay, so we're up to the next item. Ms. Wells, did you want to go through this design review?
Sure. So the question for you is, do you support administrative design review for second units if there's no exterior changes to the main structure? Right now, anything for a second unit goes to design review board. And so we're asking the question now that we can put this into our regulations for the City Council's review, of course, but and suggesting that the situation, if there's no exterior changes, may be treated differently.
Commissioner Maynard.
I would support this if we could add the language that if there's any type of modification, even a relatively minor modification, I would want it to go to DRB. If it fits within our zoning protocols, then I think it would be okay for administrative review. But if there's a modification request, I think it should go to DRB.
Commissioner Fuller.
So are you talking about second units that are entirely contained in the existing structure?
Right, yeah, with no exterior changes.
With no exterior changes, okay. So, well then, sure, administrative approval. But if there's any change to the exterior of the existing structure, then it should be reviewed, yeah.
I can support this language, administrative review without structural change. Commissioner Jenkins?
Yeah, I can support it as well.
Commissioner Daniels?
Yes.
All right. We're on to the next one. Ms. Wells.
All right, so we have another question about the administrative design review and whether or not all signs that are non-illuminated building-mounted signs outside of the Old Town Heritage Overlay should or should not go to the design review board. So would you consider allowing a non-illuminated building-mounted signs go to staff?
Okay, I'm going to take this one first because mm-hmm. this has been something that I've been talking about all the way through, and I would love to see us have an administratively approvable sign because the cost and time for sign approval is significant, and we hear it all the time from the businesses in the community. This is very narrowly focused. This is a non-illuminated building-mounted sign outside of the Old Town Heritage District. So I absolutely can support that. And I'll let anybody else make their comments.
I can support it. I'm just curious what parameters the administrative review has. I mean, will you have a cookbook set of guidelines that, you know, as far as size and limitation on that? So,
well, we don't have the guidelines. We have the regulations. So, because we're not using guidelines anymore, we're using the regs. Mm. So, and that's same holds true. Unless there are specific regs for that area mm-hmm. or guidelines for that area, it goes, the size limitations and everything are included within the zoning ordinance. Administrative design review is meant to be the intermediate step between ministerial and full DRB review. And it's also appealable, just like administrative use permits or administrative functions in the planning, the land use side, are appealable to the Planning Commission.
How would that be appealable? How would a member of the public be made aware of a sign that's going for administrative review? Is it noticed? Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
I mean, we would need to take a look at that. But for it's just like all of our administrative functions, we do have noticing requirements.
Okay.
There is a discussion about hearings versus notices of decision mm-hmm. and when the best way to use either one, and we're still having that internally. But there is that type of notice. If it is something that would come for administrative design review and is on a controversial building, is just not... it leaves the zoning administrator uncomfortable mm-hmm. in any way, it automatically elevated to the DRB.
I can support Chair Onan's comment.
I would just like to see a little further definition than just a non-illuminated building-mounted sign, because mm-hmm. any sign that gets approved, you know, then if you don't like it, you have to wait till somebody decides to change it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's conforming now. And no offense to the administrator, but you know, they may think that something's gorgeous and 90% of the public may think that it's the absolute wrong thing to do. So
90% may be an overstatement. 51%. wouldn't matter if it was 10%, it would still be a significant...
It could be controversial, yeah. Right. So maybe something a little more, you know, you say building-mounted sign. Is that a building-mounted sign that's above the rafter, you know, height, the ceiling rafter height? Or is it something that's, you know, by the door, you know, like a directory sign? Or, you know, I would certainly be willing to go along with something like that.
More defined.
Yeah, a little more limited or better defined than, you know, if somebody's going to put a 5-foot by 2-foot non-illuminated carved wood sign, you know, above their store, that might be something that we'd want to have, you know, design review board.
Well, it's important to note that it would still have to meet all the regulations for the size of sign based on the size of the building. So any exceptions to that would automatically go to design review. But it would be an administrative approval would be allowed for something that would essentially be ministerial if it was part of an overall sign plan.
Right.
But is not part of that. Therefore, it's just a limited administrative approval over the counter. Or there would be a notice and other things with it.
Right, and I still I would like to trust the administrator that if something significant, you know, is before them, that they would submit it to the design review board. However, if we put some guidelines in there, or at least some, you know, further parameters on it, then we'll know for sure that it'll, you know, get kicked up and there won't be a mistake or anything. That's all.
I think we spell out a lot of the specific in our sign in this proposal. We talk about size of sign based on frontage of the store. We talk about positioning. Mm-hmm. We have a lot at play, and it has to fit right in the box.
But I'm just talking about which signs, you know, get administrative approval versus which ones don't.
And I think if I may, that I think I understand where you're coming from. And we have a lot of notes on this section too from our discussion. Mm-hmm. So we'll work something out to get a little bit more detail on the scope or the span of the...
That'd be great.
Commissioner Maynard, did you...
Sure. So on the signs, as long as there's no modifications to what's in the zoning ordinance, I would support the administrative design. I skipped ahead a little bit. So just one thing on the second units, to go back for a second. If those are visible from the street, that might be a time when it's design review should have it. If the second units are behind the house, I'm less concerned about the design. But if it's, I'm thinking of like if there's a second unit parallel with the main house and right street forward, that might be a time when we want design review.
All right. So did we get everybody through the first bullet point?
I think so.
Okay. Administrative review. What's the second bullet point?
So the second bullet point is a question about multiple levels of design review at one DRB meeting. Mm-hmm. So right now, signs can have multiple levels of review at one meeting. And so we're checking to see if there's a, openness from on the Planning Commission side for conceptual and design review for other things than just signs.
It was actually very interesting because the board asked for this. They wanted a little more flexibility to do conceptual and design review for minor projects that didn't necessarily need to go through two steps independently. And then when we sat down and talked about it, some were very concerned about opening up this flexibility. So I was a little confused. But I think the concern was from one member that there was a way to trick the process. And it wasn't so much, we believe it adds flexibility for both the board and the applicant. If someone's gonna come in, let's say it's a minor project, and it would have to be advertised as conceptual and design review in order to grant it. That doesn't mean they have to, but it would be advertised that way so if the board felt they were ready, they could. Or they could just grant conceptual at that time and they could come back later for full DRB review. But right now, only signs can do that, is have both conceptual and design review all at the same time. But for a minor project, that could be a functional way of them dealing with that. And it was something that they wanted, a lot of them wanted, it wasn't a majority clearly from that discussion, but they wanted that type of flexibility to be able to be used by the board.
And if you can, from what I understood from the notes, they specifically were concerned that somehow this would then not be subject to any further review.
Correct.
That was the concern, which, right, of course, my understanding of it would say, no, that doesn't create that opportunity.
It enables them to grant that if they want to. Let's say something comes in, it's a minor addition, it's fully fleshed out, colors, materials, everything's ready to go, they like it, they just want to approve it. It would enable them to grant design review approval at that time instead of saying, we really think it's great, sorry, you have to come back in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And these are projects that are not going on to the Planning Commission. These
Correct.
Are small projects.
Well, actually, they could be projects that have come to you, but they wouldn't. Actually, no, you're right. You're absolutely correct, because conceptual happens before it comes
correct.
To the Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
Right. Design review happens after.
Correct.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I support this because I see that it does give flexibility. When an applicant, though, is submitting their application, they need to, in their application, then request design review.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then it's properly noticed. So even though they request it, they may not get it.
Correct.
They might just get the conceptual.
It's still at the at the board's granting.
I fully support this.
Commissioner Daniels, did you have any comment on that?
I echo Commissioner Jenkins' discussion.
Thank you. Commissioner Maynard?
I support it.
Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I just have a couple of sort of questions about this. So would this also be the one meeting, for review at the design review level? So they could have, supposedly we're going to try and limit design review to one meeting, at least that's the current intent. So this would be one meeting for both the conceptual and design review.
Correct, but there we don't limit design review to one meeting. We limit conceptual review to one meeting.
Okay, so they could have continuing meetings even under the basis of conceptual and design review. And if this were to go to the Planning Commission, because it could be an item that goes to the Planning Commission, is that correct?
No.
No, it couldn't be.
No, not a combined review can goes. So if it's an item that goes to Planning Commission, it goes to conceptual,
right,
then to Planning Commission, then back to design review.
Right.
So they wouldn't do both at the same time.
So you wouldn't be combining both of them.
Correct. I was incorrect when I had first spoken.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
And I support this concept as well. All right. So that turns the page to next steps.
You want to change those too?
I think we should have our comments on them, Commissioner Daniels. What do you think? Let's just go right to public hearing. What do you think? go ahead, Ms. Bob. Sorry.
Well, thank you for your input tonight and to the public for providing us with so much input. Mm-hmm. And we have our direction, and we will go and make it all happen with a revised draft that will be released in the coming weeks. As you know, we have been working on it, so it's not going to take it. Not we won't be reinventing the wheel, so we have a lot of good input. And then after we release it, there'll be enough time for the public to review it and for you to review it. Then we will come back to you at public hearings. Mm-hmm. So attached to that will be the environmental impact report and the actions that are required in order to adopt a first or recommend adoption of the city's first zoning ordinance.
Commissioner Mayor?
In today's staff report, you included some wonderful tables that compared the sign ordinance to the existing ordinance and to the DRB recommendations. And we didn't cover all of that today. We only covered a few pieces of it. So will the public and folks who want to make comments based on getting this new information still be able to submit public comments to you?
People can provide comment. We would, of course, we always take public comment. But we are working on the revised draft, and we're using the tables as tools and wanted everybody to have access to what we are using. It's all out there anyway, and actually want to be clear, the tables aren't a replacement to actually using the drafts that are posted on our website, that we've released in past packets. It's just a guide, but to be clear, they're not replacing the actual review of the actual wording.
They will be synthesized into the public review draft or the public hearing draft. I keep saying public review. So.
All right. We're going to go to the director's report. We're going to come back.
No, I was regarding that.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So are you still meeting with the interest groups? Or
yes, we are.
Okay, so you're still...
So stakeholder meetings are still being held. We had our largest one a couple weeks ago so far. It was supposed to be a normal stakeholder meeting, and it turned into a large meeting at the library, which one of our commissioners, a DRB member and a council member, attended. Mm. The mayor was there. It actually was a really great meeting. We fielded a lot of questions. There was a lot of input from all different facets of the community. And it was Goodland Coalition, the Citizens Planning Association, Goleta Valley Beautiful, the Westside Goleta Coalition, and I'm missing one.
League of Women Voters.
League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. All co-sponsored the event.
Okay, so. Great.
Our meeting schedule is tapering off naturally because we're working on the draft. Mm-hmm. And that's our goal, is to really invest our time into getting this revised draft out to you as soon as possible while all of our memories are fresh and this information is easily accessible to all of us, including the public. So that's where we're at. We're tapering off the meetings and investing in the revised draft.
Thank you. Director's report.
Director's report. I don't have much today. I filled you in on the meeting we had a couple weeks ago. Our next regularly scheduled meeting, I don't know if we're going to have it at this time. Wendy will confirm with you at the end of the week via email. But because, as Ann said, these meetings are going to be tapering off while we work, you may get a little bit of a break. We do have some projects working, but I don't believe anything will be ready for the next time. But again, I will confirm by the end of the week. So you may get a Monday off.
So let me confirm. I think we had reserved the 2nd as a potential meeting.
Yes.
That we know is not going to happen?
I will confirm on.
Oh, and the 9th, yeah. it would be our regular.
Actually, May 2nd will not be happening.
No.
May 9th will be confirmed.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we all have that?
Great.
That's it from the director's report?
Mm-hmm.
That's all?
Unless you have questions. I'm happy to answer any
well,
questions.
Well, you did mention that the public hearing draft, as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For as long as we can.
And do you have a hint when that... is anticipated.
That seems to be the question everyone's getting every day. But no, we do not have a time estimate, but we'll keep you updated as that moves forward.
And we're going to give ample time, have it out for the public.
Absolutely.
Have ample time and the commissioner's time to read through it.
Unless you'd like to have a public hearing with only 10 days notice in the public, which I don't think anybody would like to
do. We would all prefer not
yes.
to do that. All right, so let's go to commissioner's comments. We'll start with you, Commissioner Maynard.
So just one more question on timing. Do we know when Shelby's likely to come up?
No, we don't.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fuller?
Thank you all very much.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Ditto that.
Commissioner Daniels?
Andy, maybe, probably, because he's the one taking notes. When Mr. Wicko got up to speak, I believe he was talking about, well, he was suggesting line four, and I think what he really meant was bullet point four. He said it a number of times.
Yeah, it was line four in the staff report.
Yes.
And bullet five on the slide.
Yeah.
That was killing me too.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else, Commissioner Daniels?
No, I that's what I wanted to say earlier. Thank
okay,
you very
and
much.
Nothing from the chair.
Thank you.
Motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Meeting adjourned.